Blog Talk Radio.
Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, spiritual relationship healing expert, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love, author of the book Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, director of HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com, and Healing Through Love Seminars. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter how old you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can, and often does, get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Today, I have the very special privilege of speaking with Dr. Deborah Wingfield, author and trainer in family violence treatment and prevention. Dr. Wingfield developed and taught a domestic violence counselor training curriculum at the University of Southern Colorado, now Colorado State in Pueblo. As a practicing counselor from 1975 to 2002 with delinquent youth, families with child abuse and neglect issues, adults and children from all dysfunctional family types, and domestic violence victims, child witness victims, and offenders, Dr. Wingfield designed and implemented programs that address all of these different issues. In her research, she used a transactional analysis model exploring adult perceptions of family of origin dynamics related to alcoholic, abusive, and chronic illness families. She holds a master's degree in counseling and organizational psychology and a doctorate in counselor education. So I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Deborah Wingfield.
Thank you, Erica, and it's my pleasure to be here today.
So I would really love to begin by asking you to share a little bit about your background and training and experience and your own ultimate journey toward working with these really, really important and sometimes neglected aspects of life and relationships.
Well, I have to laugh about how I actually got into working in the area of domestic violence. I was nearing the end of my doctoral program and starting my doctoral internship, and I was invited to sit in a group of domestic violence offenders because the co-facilitator of that group was not available that night, and I didn't have any clients, so I was free to do that. And after having done groups for many years, I felt confident that I could walk into that group and be able to handle whatever was presented by the members of the group. And what astounded me more than anything was the reception from a nonverbal standpoint that I received from each person who walked into that group. This was a group of men who had been arrested for domestic violence offenses that in the state of Colorado is considered an assault, and domestic violence is a sentence enhancer on that because it happens within an intimate relationship. I left that group saying to the co-facilitator that before I would sit in another group with domestic violence offenders, I needed to be specially trained for that. I didn't understand the dynamics of domestic violence. I didn't understand why the anger was being so strongly directed at me nonverbally. And I knew that there were underlying dynamics and issues with the members of this group, as well as other domestic violence offender treatment groups, that needed to be addressed. And in order to be able to do that, I needed to understand what drove them, what motivated them to behave in the ways that they did behave. And as a result of that, I learned a great deal about coercive control and what coercive control is.
It's really fascinating and so important. So I would like to ask you if you could kind of explain, what is the difference between what we think of as control and coercive control?
Well, Erica, let me start out and just give you a definition of coercive control. And this is a definition from Evan Stark's book on coercive control. And he defines it as a pattern of oppression, an offense to liberty that prevents women from freely developing their personhood, utilizing their capacities, or practicing citizenship. Consequences they experience as entrapment. So the difference between control and coercive control is the fact that there is that sense of being forced into behaving in a way that pleases the other person and takes away the personhood of the individual who is being controlled.
That is really
so
intense.
We have to look at the motivation behind the control to determine if the person is attempting to gain power over an individual or they're just trying to guide that person. So if we look at it from the standpoint of a parent who is concerned about their child making decisions that could be harmful to them, they may exert a certain amount of control and say, no, you can't go with this particular friend, or you can't go to this particular activity because it could be a danger to you. That's not an oppression. What that is that's a concern about that person's well-being. With coercive control, we're looking at a dynamic process of patterns over time. So it's not just a single incident. It's a multitude of patterns over time. And those patterns are motivated by molding that person to do exactly what you want them to do. And we even go to the point of looking at the literature on hostage taking. We look at the literature on what happens to a hostage over time and the whole issue of Stockholm syndrome that occurs when someone has been taken a hostage and then basically brainwashed to behave and act in the ways that the hostage taker desires. That is the oppression point that we're talking about with coercive control.
Really an important topic that is not looked at enough. So you are focusing at the moment a lot in co-parenting and how coercive control is used in co-parenting. So please talk about the different types of coercive control used.
Okay. Well, one of the things that we do know is that the types of coercive control that are used during a relationship very often continue after the relationship dissolves, whether there's a separation because the couple was never married, or there's a divorce because they were married, we still see those same dynamics occurring. And as we look at those different dynamics, we see them maybe manifesting differently when an individual is no longer living with that person, but they have children together. So the attempts to control continue. And some of the different types of coercive control that occur in a relationship as well as beyond the relationship, include using privilege. And privilege is basically a form of entitlement. It says, I'm better than you are. I know what's best here. I'll make all the decisions. I'll be in charge. We also see coercive control in the way that an individual manipulates the children or manipulates through threats of harming the child, keeping the child away from the other parent. And so children are a big part of the whole issue of co-parenting. But within that, we see blaming. We see denial of responsibility by the coercive controller. We see them minimizing their part in anything that might be damaging to the children. We also see them using intimidation, threats, and coercion with the co-parent in ways that they say, well, if you don't do what I want to do, then I'll take you back to court and we'll let the judge tell you that you're going to do it my way. So we see those kinds of threats. And an example of that was a mother that I was working with whose daughter asked to go to church with her grandparents. And when she shared that with her father, he became livid over the fact that this child had gone to this church and he hadn't given permission for that, even though the child was with the mother and the mother did not force this child to go to church. What she did is she agreed to do that because the child asked. But now we have a threat, I'm going to take you back to court and the judge will tell you that you can't take her to a church without my permission. Well, I've just recently run across some case law that will actually undermine his threat, because what he's doing in there is he's actually violating case law. So
you have to know these laws.
Right.
You have to know what your rights are.
And this is very true. And one of the things that we have problems with is mothers and sometimes fathers who go into court without legal representation and are representing themselves end up making agreements that are not in the best interests of their children, that are not in the best interests of the parent. And very often we're seeing cases that end up in court where coercive control is constantly being used. And let me just kind of give you some examples from the statistics that we know on divorce and co-parenting. We're not talking about the majority of co-parents here. What we're talking about is 10% of all the cases are involved in a relationship dissolving. In those 10% of the cases, we're seeing 58,000 children actually being placed in the custody of their abusive parent. And in the other 90% of the cases, those cases may never see a courtroom. They may never have the kinds of coercive control that we're talking about. So from the standpoint of numbers, if you look at 58,000 children a year over an 18-year time span, we have millions or thousands of children, hundreds of thousands of children, who are in the court system and are constantly being put in a situation where one parent is attempting to control the other parent, using coercive control even after decisions have been made and judges have identified the responsibilities for each of the parents. So we have some real serious issues going on with this 10% of the cases. And one of the types of abuse that occurs in those cases is economic abuse. I have talked to numerous mothers who are attempting to protect their children from further abuse because the children have reported it: physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, neglect by their fathers primarily, but sometimes by their mothers. And what the coercive controlling parent does is they keep going back to court over and over and over again until the protective parent ends up with no money, often bankrupt. I've even learned about families that have gone bankrupt in attempts to protect their grandchildren from this type of controlling behavior. And still, what we're seeing in the courts is the courts are turning around and placing these children in the primary parenting responsibility of the abusive parent. And when that happens, what happens is the protective parent is doing everything they can to help their child stay as safe as they can in that situation, and the situation continues to deteriorate for the children, and the protective parent continues to feel even less and less like they have any ability to stand up to the coercive controller. So part
well,
I
have a few questions here. Like, how can, if you are this parent that wants to protect your child, how can you tell if coercive control is being used against you, you know, and what can you do about it?
Great questions, Erica. One of the things that I'm doing is I'm writing a book right now for protective parents to understand what coercive control is in all its many forms, and we haven't talked about all the different forms here. And in each of those chapters of that book are assessments for individuals to take to actually look at whether different types of coercive control tactics are being used in their relationship as far as the co-parenting process is concerned. Now, the relationship, as far as the intimate part of that relationship, has ended, but the co-parenting continues at least until the children are 18 and have aged out of the court system. So, excuse me, one of the things that we see very often is co-parents not knowing that they're actually being coercively controlled because they don't know all the little nuances of that type of coercive control. So in the book, what I've done is I've actually come through with a number of lists that I've compiled from multiple resources, authors who've written about what's happening in these situations and focus those more specifically on the types of behaviors, the types of actions that are being taken, some of the comments that are being said to co-parents. And this is the first step, is first of all identifying what it is that excuse me, the co-parent is using, and then moving to that next step of learning how to manage the response of the protective parent to the co-parent so that the co-parent doesn't gain ammunition against them. And one of the things that you and I both know about relationships is because there's emotional connections attached when we form relationships, just because we end those relationships doesn't mean that those emotional connections are not still there. They are very present. And what the abuser or coercive controller is attempting to do is they're attempting to capitalize on that emotional connection to continue to manipulate and control their former partner. And the only leverage they have is around the children that they both have together. So they continue to use that. And what I'm doing in this book that will be coming out within the next 6 months is I am actually providing protective parents with the skills and tools to be able to respond in a way that stops that emotional connection that will keep arguments going and keep drawing people back into court over and over and over again.
So I have another question. Okay. Maybe if you could give an example of a typical victim, you know, the non-coercive parent that I'm calling a victim, a typical response that that person might have that is continuing the coercive control instead of limiting it.
Okay. And I'd like to remove the word victim because the person that is being coercively controlled is actually being a protective parent.
Okay, that's good.
And so one of the things that I can tell you is there are sometimes threats of keeping the children away from the protective parent. And there are cases upon cases where the coercive controlling parent has actually manipulated the court system to the point where they gain sole parenting time or sole custody, depending on which state you're in. The language is changing. And it's important to understand that some states are now identifying this as parenting time, not custody. But the children are in the primary or sole parenting responsibility of the coercive controlling parent. And the protective parent is actually being required to have supervised visits with the children. And the way that the court sees this is that because the parent is trying to protect their child from abuse, protect their child from neglect, the court is viewing this as you're not a friendly parent, and therefore you might keep the child away from the other parent. So therefore, you can only see your child in a supervised setting. What then happens, and I've seen this in numerous cases, is the coercive controlling co-parent refuses to bring the children to the supervised visits. Now, the protective parent has made the arrangements for this visit is responsible for paying for that visit. And if the children don't show up, the protective parent still must pay for that visit. And the coercive controlling parent is, at the same time, undermining any kind of relationship that their children have with their protective parent. Now, I know I just talked about that in a very general, gender-neutral standpoint. What I can tell you is primarily the protective parent is the mother, and primarily the coercive controlling parent is the father. And we see that in case after case after case.
So what can be done about it? Is there something that the protective parent can do to not escalate that situation?
One of the things that a protective parent can do is to attempt, and this is an attempt, this is not necessarily a guarantee that it's going to work, but attempt to communicate with the coercive controlling parent before it reaches that point of him refusing to allow the children to have contact with her, and attempt to communicate in ways that say, I'm working with you, I'm making every attempt to work in our children's best interest, not what you have rights to or what I have rights to as parents, but what is best for our children. And when we're looking at what is best for your children, part of what we're looking at is how can the children have contact with both parents in a way that's safe for the child. Now, if there is documented abuse that's occurring, documented neglect that's occurring, those are situations that we're running into a great deal of difficulty with the court system, because we have different courts that address those issues, and we haven't come to a way for those courts to come together and work together for the best interests of that child. And this gives leverage to the coercive controller to continue to go back into the family relations courts and get the family relations courts to actually support their position. And without the financial wherewithal that many protective mothers lose as a part of this whole process, they don't have the ability to continue to fight these kinds of battles in the court system. And what we end up with is we end up with children who are harmed for life. And
what I'm hearing here is that you have a huge task, and it's really admirable that you've taken on this task. So I would love you to share how the listeners could get in touch with you. I know you have other books that are out there, so just talk about that briefly.
Okay, there's two books out there right now. One is From Darkness to Light, Your Inner Journey, and that book was written to help adults who have grown up in any type of dysfunctional family system or who have been involved in a dysfunctional family system as an adult who want to heal from that type of dysfunction. That book is out there and available on a website called YourSoulTransformed.com. And let me just repeat that, YourSoulTransformed.com. I have a second book that I wrote for the children who have gone through these horrendous battles, who have been abused, who have been neglected in these situations, for them to start their healing process. And that book is called Through a Child's Voice. And it allows them to use a journaling process to actually understand what has happened to them and to start that healing journey for themselves. I also do training, and my training is on my website, houseofpeacepubs.com, and I'll just spell that out because some people get mixed up with that. It's HouseofPeacePubs, as in Peter, UBS, as in Sam.com. So it's houseofpeacepubs.com. And I offer training to professionals or anyone who's interested in learning more about the dynamics of domestic violence, both victims and offenders. And I also look at the silent victim witnesses, who are the children, and helping them. So those books are available. You can contact me through houseofpeacepubs.com, and there's a link there to email me directly on that website.
Okay, Dr. Deborah, we have just about run out of time. So this was really, really informative, and I'm sure there are a lot of parents that will value this and contact you. So thank you so much for coming today.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure and my honor. Thank you for inviting me.
So I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, healthybabyboomersnetwork.com, to get your free report, How to Live to 100 and Beyond, or schedule a counseling or coaching session at drericawellness.com.